This is Critical Nonsense, our high-lowbrow show about culture, science, and tech. This week, special guest Matt Millington joins us to talk about the future of food and having a dog.
Oh, hello. And we're here.
Oh.
And it's me, and it's what a joy sounds like.
Oh, yeah, and this, I suppose, is what Anne Aaron sounds like.
And this is what a Jess Vander celebration cake eater and executive producer sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess.
Celebration cake eater? I don't know. You've had
some really
celebration
cake. I called it freedom cake.
Freedom cake.
Yesterday,
yeah.
Wow.
Yesterday night was my first day out of self-isolation after 3 weeks. So I was able to exit one room and then enter another room. And it was really cool.
That's huge.
Your world expanded immensely.
Yeah, it was great.
And this is what a Matt, who's been in the design industry over 15 years, a strong believer in the power of human-centered design and applied technology to solve human problems, sounds like. Wow. Matt Millington.
Sounds pretty grand. I'm also the guy that sounds a bit like Harry Potter, so it's easy to pick my voice out.
It was something that had been starkly missing in our podcast history, and we needed to resolve it.
That's
truly why we're speaking to you, not because of your 15 years of experience and expertise in design and food. It's really just because we were checking off on the list that we just needed someone who sounded like Harry Potter.
Great,
it's true.
Right. I'm available for knockoff cheap Harry Potter voiceovers if need be. I'm not doing much right now. I've got a microphone.
The reality is that somehow the audience who might be looking for knockoff cheap Harry Potter sound work is probably our audience.
Yes.
Awesome.
That's right. I mean, if there would be anybody looking for it, it would be Critical Nonsense listeners.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
So, Joey, what is, it's not really on your mind, but what's on our collective minds? Tell us, spin us a yarn.
Well, so we have been talking a bunch about the future of food and conversations about food with our sort of quarantine situation. And that is sort of the prime setup for why we have Matt here, because Matt is been living food and technology and design for the past 15 years. And so, and, you know, not just at work, in his personal life, growing vegetables out in the countryside in England. So we decided to have Matt on to talk to us about that. So Matt, what is the future of food?
For me, depends on what's in my fridge right now.
Got it. So, the immediate future.
We're talking
about multiple time horizons.
Okay. I think that's beautiful. We should start with the immediate future. What is your immediate future of food?
The near future of my food is pretty weird at the moment, being as we're all in lockdown at the moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tried to polish my Halo the other day, and with a view to getting the kids out of the house and to engage in nature and a bit of wild food, I told my daughter, who's 8, that we could... I said, hey, you know, you can eat pretty much anything around you. Some cuisines, like Vietnamese food, is very much inspired by stuff that they had to eat, like wild herbs and things. And there were a load of stinging nettles. I said, well, you know, we can eat stinging nettles. And she kind of looked at me as if to say, you're absolutely nuts, which she does quite a lot. So the next day we went back with some gloves on. She took her gloves but refused to pick the stinging nettles because she said she'd get stung. I was fine for about 10 minutes until like the little hairs on the stinging nettles worked their way through my gloves. Ooh. And started stinging my hands.
Ugh.
So I was hoping the future of my COVID-19 lockdown food was going to be kind of semi-wild.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite romantic. And then we made a stinging nettle soup, which was an incredible bright green. and it was bloody awful.
Oh no!
So it turns out that look of craziness was founded.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she was right.
She was like, you're going to get stung and it's going to be revolting. I was like, no, it's great. You know, we got to learn to fend for ourselves. These are interesting times right now. You know, you got to find nutrition where you can get it. So, you know, maybe the future of food is there is an element of it being wild. You know, there's lots of talk, particularly that guy Joe Rogan talking about, you know, why you should eat wild food and go hunting with your bow and arrow that we all seem to not do. And why, like,
I'm
wild
just imagining
food is
Aaron with a bow and arrow out
It'd be
in
ridiculous.
The woods.
It would be like me with a bow and arrow in Fort Greene Park, just throwing it at things. Like, I wouldn't
that
even
would
use it the way, you know, it might work. It might
just
work.
People's
stun
terriers
it.
And
beating a squirrel to death.
Exactly. There could be something in that. There
you
could
can
be
squirrels.
You can eat them. You know, in New York City, Steve Brill does these foraging tours around Central Park and other spaces, and teaches you what you can and cannot eat just walking around in nature, which is very interesting. I don't know if all of them are always good per your discovery, but it's possible.
There's something super romantic about it, right? I mean, I think it's sort of like in like the golden ageism that we always sort of find ourselves in of sort of foraging for your own food, but that like also the sort of American idea of like self-reliance and things like that sort of come into it. And, you know, there have been a couple things over the past few years in like food documentaries or shows like the Great British Baking Show. There was that guy that was talking about making like roadkill meat pies and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And or there's the Swedish guy who has been like going really hard into like Swedish terroir, basically, of saying like, you know, if it grows together, it goes together type of thinking, and just like, what can you eat from, you know, starting to use like birch bark in things and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know people have been using, I don't know what the species is, but a certain type of ant for citrus mm-hmm. instead of lemons, which obviously don't grow in the UK. But there's quite a big point in there. I think the reason we're in the state we are with our food systems at the moment is one of the biggest drivers of capitalism is choice. Mm-hmm. We expect choice. We expect to be able to buy things out of season even, which is completely insane, mm-hmm. mainly because we're not informed as consumers, and it's not really our fault, but choice is a really big deal. And going local actually creates a whole new area of choice and variety, which wasn't there before. So you get things like, you know, I think Scandinavia was historically not really looked at as a sort of culinary center. But they went back to the land and started innovating. And, you know, when you start to take things away that you rely on, like lemon juice, for example, you might end up finding an ant that squirts out a certain type of acid that tastes exactly like lemons. So, you know, I'd like to think that the future of food is very diverse, but just in a very different way.
Yeah, there. That same thing is like with David Chang doing sort of those, like, what's each culture's umami bomb, like looking for what is sort of, you know, like soy is sort of much more endemic to Asia, and they have soy sauce and things like that for umami bombs, whereas Italy has, you know, stewed tomatoes, or other places have other things. But that idea of like that you can find sort of an equivalent of the experience you're looking for by taking a little bit more of a scientific approach has always been something that's like super compelling to me, where you start to see some of those fusions happening.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what a native British umami bomb would be. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Sort of grey weather and sadness mainly. that's what we thrive on. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting, too, is that I'm thinking about this, like, near-term future of food, sort of, like, literally what is in the next day and a half in my fridge, and everything is coming out in two ways. I'm either eating the most processed, nostalgic childhood foods that I could possibly bulk order on Amazon a month ago, like childhood cereals. I have these zebra cakes from Little Debbie that are just, like, they're crap.
Yeah,
so bad.
Truly.
They will have a shelf life of a billion years, but I will eat it and I will love it. So there's like that half, and then there's the other half of my kitchen, which is like making cannellini bean soup, like from kind of scratch, that I haven't thought through, but I'm like, let me throw some andouille sausage in there and some thyme and like a little bit of tomato. Like I'm finding myself getting really creative in the kitchen. And basically with the way that we get our groceries, about 5 days into the week is when we hit the chop challenge for two nights. And it's like, go in, pull whatever the hell is in there and it's about to go bad and make something good out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's in that moment that I start to have to figure out, okay, like how am I going to umami-fy this? Like, how am I going to salt this with this weird set of stuff that I have left? And my favorite question is like, I've got 8 different acids. I've got like apple cider vinegar. I've got some lemon juice, some lime juice. I've got like this, that, and the other. Let me just like try it. See what happens.
The British umami bomb is probably like a small fish of some sort, like a sardine or an anchovy or something like that. I just realized as you were talking.
It would be a salted fish or meat.
Yes, yeah. Or I HP guess. Sauce. Would it be HP sauce?
Yeah, that's full of umami.
Yeah.
That, from tomatoes, yeah.
That's,
probably. Yeah.
That's
from
what we come to, HP? Come on.
Yeah. But it's from tomatoes and tamarind, so it's kind of not really officially very British. That doesn't grow here.
That's fair. That's fair.
You guys have wild tomatoes, I'm sure.
No.
Nope.
No way. Not a chance.
No.
It's amazing. Okay. No.
We have wild strawberries and things like that, but not wild tomatoes.
Got it.
Excuse my pronunciation of tomato.
Yeah.
I kind of have a question for you, actually, Aaron, in that, do you think this lockdown thing is going to change the way people approach food? Because what you're talking about is, you know, there's food for nostalgia, food for comfort, but also you're having to cook from scratch and be more creative, and kind of looks like you're enjoying that as well. Do you think this is going to help people understand food better when previously they didn't even need to bother?
I think it's such a cool question, because we've had such a strong food media culture over the years celebrating how to do all these different things, but may or may not have had the time to try these things out, or even had the concentration to focus on all of the different techniques, or shows like Chopped or whatever that sort of like raid your kitchen and try to put that together. And I think it's probably going to change in a couple ways. I think one is that just by spending more time with food, we're likely to have a much stronger opinion about what is going into our bodies, because we are so much more frequently responsible for directly putting it into our bodies, as opposed to like ordering in or shopping around. This is also a very like, you know, urban view of like ordering in 5 nights a week. But then the other bit too is starting to actually develop an interest in food. So for those people who actually didn't engage in food, I don't know that overnight they'll become like, you know, people who just love cuisine and love to do that. But I do think that people will start to get more creative and start to find different ways to find satisfaction. Mm. Like, is it just a slice of cheddar? Like, is that what kind of gets it for you, instead of the zebra cake or the Little Debbie thing that you can't necessarily get as easily anymore?
The thing that I've noticed, I think that's true. Like, I agree with all of that. The thing that for me, the first response was sort of about the environmental impact, actually, of food waste reduction. Like, I felt like in the past we were okay. Like, we were trying to not waste food, but, you know, a lot of our habits sort of still resulted in some wasted food. But because both were trying not to get out of the house as, you know, reduce the amount we're going out of the house as much as possible, as well as sort of trying to capitalize in weird moments where we're both working and have the baby and preparing so that we have leftovers and things like that, is our food waste has gone down to almost zero. Like, everything is getting eaten, and that sort of environmental impact, if everyone is starting to sort of dramatically reduce food waste, is pretty significant.
And it also, I think, it means that we have to start, I guess the definition of staples also gets called into question. So there's one thing that I experienced that probably everybody experienced in different ways, which is that there was something that I sort of used as an anchor in my cooking that became scarce. So like there were a couple of weeks where I could not get chicken. It was just like, I couldn't get chicken, couldn't get thighs, couldn't get breasts, couldn't get any chicken, period. And so all of a sudden I had to figure out what, like, I had to explore something else. I had to adapt to whatever else was available. And I started getting creative about what was left over from that. Mm-hmm. So like, there were little things that even at home I started to hold on to. Like, I think Jess knows my trick with Parmesan cheese rinds and vegetable scraps. Like, throw the cheese rind in stew. It'll get delicious and cheesy. Throw the scraps into some water and make broth. Like, you don't have to throw anything away yourself, and you can cut down on your own, or you can make more out of what you have as well.
Yeah, make it stretch.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, beyond your stinging nettle excursion, has your personal experience in quarantine given you any indication, or has it married at all with any of your background in knowing about future foods? Have those two things come together at all?
I mean, I think in general, I have this sort of aspiration to be self-sufficient. So we built a greenhouse, and there's like the odd shoot of something coming through in the seeds that we sowed, and we got some bits and bobs coming through in the veg patch. But there was a very drastic realization that there's no way we could be self-sufficient in the way that I'm approaching growing vegetables and things at the moment. I'm mainly doing it for fun and because I like cooking, and you know, I like being outside. But to be able to actually feed my family is quite an interesting thing to think about when I've never actually had to consider it anymore. So I think the kind of isolation period has made me think about what it would take to actually feed a family of four. Certainly the children are not wasting food quite so much anymore, and we stop having to say, can you finish what you've got in front of you, please? Because now we've actually got a reason. It's like, no, guys, that you need to eat everything. We can't be wasting food right now. The world is needs to change a little bit here. I think one of the biggest realizations is, though, is it's not necessarily consumers that are going to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem comes from wastage, not in the home. I mean, obviously, it's great not to waste food in the home, but the biggest wastage comes from food production itself. So, you know, way, way earlier on in the food chain is where most of the wastage comes in. I mean, I think we can affect that based on what we buy. So consumer demand obviously changes that. But it's the food production methods where things are actually, you know, they need the most help. So food storage, for example, you know, huge amount of food is wasted when it's stored or transported. We only get a very small amount of what comes through. So it was kind of, on one hand, I was beating myself up for not being able to be self-sufficient and thinking, you know, my aspirations were ridiculous. But on the other hand, I think we as consumers, perhaps, I think we think we can solve the problem, but it's food production which needs to change quite drastically.
Yeah, I think some of the stuff in that's come out that's been really interesting in the food production side and the idea of sustaining a family is a lot of it is in, I think, the semiotics of food production and like gardening and things like that, of like in my mind, and I don't know if it's the same for you guys, like having a garden in my mind is like perfectly like straight rows of like sections of like, this is like a red section with like tomatoes, and this is, you know, the pumpkin patch or whatever. But a lot of the advances that seem to be happening now are these sort of, you know, like biodynamic, sustainable farms. Like I saw in the chef show that's on Netflix, Jon Favreau's show with Roy Choi, they went to Skywalker Ranch. And at Skywalker Ranch, there's like a state gardener chef woman who's like managing like all the food growth as well as the cooking. And she's done these sort of like wild things where her gardens look like sort of just overgrown patches of like nature. Like there's sort of walking pathways in between, but in the actual garden, it's sort of like a mess. And it's really specific. Like she put a bunch of tomatillos in throughout all of the garden because the tomatillos are super hardy and they draw all the insects towards them. Mm. And so they can handle having their leaves chewed up and whatever and still grow fruit, and it protects like the other things that she's growing around it. And then you just have a ton of tomatillos so you can make a lot of salsa or whatever. It's like everything is still, everything has a purpose and everything is edible, but that, you know, like to make the soil work better and to, you know, not have to use pesticides and all of these things, people are coming up with interesting solutions, but it just doesn't look like what you expect of like nice straight lined garden. It is sort of like just a wild patch of land that has all the things you need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're seeing it's moving very slowly, but there are a lot of advances in agriculture moving from just mass planting of monocultures, as in like one one crop, which kind of creates a desert from a biodiversity perspective, to being able to plant multicultures. The thing is, it's very difficult to harvest a multiculture, so there's lots of innovation that needs to happen and is happening to be able to enable these models. So, you know, some of these models are really, really ancient. Like, I think I was reading a, I can't remember the name of the chef now. He's a very famous Mexican chef. Can't remember his name. But part of his cookbook, there was a little bit that he was talking about sort of Mayan food cultivation. I think it was called a milpa. It's like a way of growing multiple different crops in a single field that basically provides all of your nutritional requirements for a family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got your corn grows really tall, but actually maize is fairly lacking in quite a few areas nutritionally. But some plants need that structure to be able to grow up it. You've got, so all of these plants actually form a much more complex web or ecosystem and attract more bugs, more insects, which tend to sort of keep each other in check, require less pesticides and things like that. So there's some very ancient farming techniques where, you know, humans were able to harvest multiple different things because we got hands and brains, etc. But now you're seeing robotics being brought into agriculture at a field level. So some friends of mine who I've been working with previously own a company called Small Robot Company, and they make really small robots that are farming robots.
Appropriate
so,
name.
You know, yeah, exactly. So rather than rolling in a huge, great, big kind of John Deere with really heavy wheels and crushing and compromising the structure of the soil, they make really small robots that skim across the top. And the robots are smart. They can deploy insecticide or pesticide to a single plant rather than blanket spraying an entire field. So I think food production is becoming much, much smarter. And I'm really kind of, you know, massively optimistic about it. But there's still quite a ways to go. I think there's a lot of focus on we as the consumer should be doing this and we should all be vegan. But actually, I think a lot of the change is going to come much further up the food chain, which is what fascinates me.
Yeah, I feel like we've learned that monoculture lesson so many times, but it never actually sunk in, right? Like that first really big example that I can think of was like the Irish potato famine, right? Where it was like there was this discovery that you could get your like full nutritional complement from cow's milk and potatoes, and Ireland thrived and then, you know, succumbed to the blight of that attacked their potato crop because it was sort of one genetic culture and it was all susceptible to that one attack. And so we like learned that lesson in theory, but we've just done it over and over again with, you know, whether it's like the bananas or, you know, some of these other crops that were, you know, we've seen it in different apple crops and things like that. We're like, we won't do that again. And then all of a sudden we like find ourselves back, right? Like, we lost the, whatever it was, the, what was it called? The Big Joe, the Big Mark, the Fat Mark. What was the banana? I can't remember.
The Big Mike? The Big Mike versus the Cavendish banana. Oh, as Daisy Walker, a previous special guest, had taught us about.
Yeah, wow. The Grand Michel, a.k.a. the Big Mike, was succumbed to monoculture.
It was gross,
and we're
Michel,
like, we won't.
Yes.
Yeah, whatever. we won't do this again. And then we're right back where we were with the Cavendish.
Well, we're nothing if we're not human.
Yeah.
But I think what Matt's saying gives us hope about the future, even if it might not start with, I'm doing my wrap-up corner. You can't.
I was about to say, did we just stumble into Jess's wrap-up corner?
We're doing
Jess's
it.
Wrap-up corner.
Exactly. While we might not, you know, even though it might feel like we're doing our best to contribute in our, you know, our small ways of helping, not wasting food at home, trying to be more self-sufficient at home, the truth is that the future of food probably lies in a lot of sort of infrastructural change that will need to happen on a much broader scale that technology might be able to help usher in, that honestly consumer buying behaviors might be able to help usher in. And maybe in the meantime, we can just eat our, what did you call it? Your Debbie Dinosaur.
Little Debbie next. Zebra cakes. It's
thank
okay.
you. And we'll just we'll
but
just
I'm interested
hope
in Little Debbie
through.
Dinosaur cakes too.
What is
I do want
cake?
Little Debbie dinosaurs. Does Little Debbie make dinosaur cakes? And
maybe.
Matt, does the UK have Little Debbie?
I don't know who Little Debbie is. I think she might live down the road or something.
Yeah.
I think she, my daughter goes to school with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll send you a picture. That's the best you'll probably get.
It's a hexagon, two-tiered cake that is covered in white icing with like little zebra chocolate lines on the top of it.
Sweet hexagonal zebra snack. It's just what the world needs.
That's what the world needs.
Exactly.
What the world needs now is cake. Sweet cake.
It's true.
It's so true. And we are back. We're back. I don't know. I suppose back again. That's not a song, but it could be. I spent a lot of time in this apartment, guys. I'm sorry. Yeah. So, you know, I was having a conversation with my dog trainer a couple of weeks ago because, yes,
as you're wont to do.
Indeed. She's incredible. I love her.
Why don't you marry her?
I mean, I would. She's awesome. I want to hang with her all the time and, you know, social distancing / restraining order. So in any case, we were having a conversation over email because I had some questions about our dog and why he was sort of like whining a little bit more often in the past couple of weeks. And we just sort of stumbled into this conversation about all of the dogs that are being adopted and fostered right now and how shelters are like emptying out all over the world. People are really using this as a moment to bring a pet into their lives, specifically dogs, and to help sort of like create structure and ease anxiety and like have companionship in all of this. And, you know, my natural response was like, isn't that awesome? And she immediately was like, I'm actually terrified because all of these pets, once we get out of COVID, like, are people going to be able to transition into whatever life is going to become and still be able to keep this responsibility? And how many of these dogs are going to go back into shelters? And I was like, oh, that's a really heartbreaking and very, very rational thought from a canine expert. Oh, dear. So I've been thinking a lot about what that means, and I just have a very, very simple question for us. And this is, let's consider it a public service announcement. What are the pros and cons of raising a dog?
Which side do you want to start on?
Yeah, I know, right? You know,
I feel
what?
Like the pros are like pretty obvious, right? Or maybe they're not. I don't know.
Maybe they're not. I feel like they're hidden pros. Like they're the basic pros that everybody knows about. Like, they're cute as hell. They're so, well, when they're cute as hell.
Yeah.
And they're so sweet and they're funny and they do derpy little things and they're little weirdos that have their own personalities. And you're just like, look at you. What are you going to do next? Oh, you did a thing.
I love that you went for cute first. I immediately went for, I think it's something like, one of the best things you can do to extend your own lifespan is to buy a dog.
Yeah,
truth.
Like,
so true.
An extra 10 years. Something crazy like that.
No, that is legit.
Why is
if
that?
If you don't want diabetes, get a dog.
Well, mainly for the exercise, but also stress reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also am reading some very abstract part of the internet around they actually bring more germs into your home, which in this day and age is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
get as long as it's not the COVID one, that's not good.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Yeah,
but also you're getting Joey started on his favorite topic, which is like germs that are good. So
yeah, the hygiene hypothesis. Let's go.
Oh yes, that is your happy space. No, that is true, and I think the stress reduction bit of it is like obviously what is like shooting their stock through the roof right now, where it's like having something that is like the flip side of dependency is. Just like, maybe not the flip side, but another shade of it is complete love, adoration, and affection. And just like, I really just want to spend time with you. That's like, I have sort of been bred over the years to want to hang out with you. Mm-hmm. And that's wild. That is so cool. And there's nothing like that in the world.
That's crazy. That I think they're one of the only animals that can actually read our facial expressions.
Yes. Yes.
And I was watching a kids program the other day, because I do it anyway. But I think it was like dogs were domesticated before even cows and sheep.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, yeah.
They get us.
Yeah. And there is like a lot of stuff to the point that you're making, Aaron, of that we evolved alongside dogs as much as they did, right? Like there was sort of like this mutual evolution that was happening of sort of, you know, people who were more attuned to care for a dog or appreciate animals in a certain way were more likely to survive because they had the support of an animal like a dog, right? Like it was truly this mutually beneficial thing that all the way up until, you know, maybe 200 years ago, like is when dogs started moving out of being working animals into the vast majority today are purely, you know, companion animals. But, you know, obviously there are still working dogs, but it is the exception and not the norm now. And you hear a lot of people actually talk about that within the context of like what's going to happen in our automated future, right? Where we don't have a purpose anymore. What are we going to do? And some people will point back to the dogs and be like, we have more dogs now than we've ever had. Dogs are thriving in this context where they don't have a job anymore. And so hopefully people will be able to do that same thing in an automated future.
Well, I mean, to double down on that, thinking specifically about working breeds, raising a working breed into becoming a companion dog is like its own aspect of training and its own aspect of like, creating a calm home because like working breeds do well with a job. That's Germans, that's like Huskies, that's Terriers. And it is shocking if you start to like find both games and toys that will scratch that instinctual itch. They are so like, they're truly happier because they lose that sense of their own anxiety over like, well, what am I supposed to do next? And it's like, here, burrow into this donut shaped dog bed for an hour, you'll be fine. It's like, oh, that did it. Because you think there's a squirrel in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's purpose, right? Like, I had a dog that was, he's with my parents now because he did not take well to the baby, but he's probably like a Rottweiler Doberman mix, which is two different types of working dogs with two different types of vibes, but like he just needed a purpose. Like if he thought that there was a bug or an animal in the house, like he would just stand guard, right? Like we had a mouse at one point and he would just like stare into corners, but he was happier somehow while he was doing it. He's like, I'm on alert. If this mouse or like silverfish comes out, I'm on it.
Oh yeah. I mean, Roof, my dog's Rufio, for what it's worth, and he has gotten to...
has he got a red mohawk?
We're this close. We're this close to getting him one. Just like, it was going to be for his birthday, which is in 2 weeks, but, you know, we're just going to save it for later in the year. We'll see. But he's taken to just like going to the window and sort of standing guard on the mountain peak. That's sort of what's going through his mind, we think. Because he just sort of looks out and he's like, all right, yep, there are some things down there and they're not coming up here. Cool. All right, we're good. And he just loves it. He'll do it for like an hour and a half. And it's just like, all right, I'm glad that that's like doing it for you.
Yeah, the protection thing is a pro, even of having like a terrier, right? Like,
yes,
the bark, not the bite, is what is actually most effective in home security. It's alerting someone that you're there. And if someone's trying to break into your home and hears a dog and they don't know whether you're home or not, all of a sudden they know that you've been like alerted that someone is trying to get in, whether or not they know you're there or not. And that is enough. Homes with dogs in them have, you know, dramatically less chance of being robbed because there's just something there, like standing watch.
You're going to go for the house next door that doesn't have the possibility of getting bitten, even if it's by a small furry terrier.
100%. Yeah. And also that bark is good for like, I don't know, personal idiot protection, where, for example, you make cannellini bean stew, put it in a rubber container and put it on top of the stovetop so that it can cool down before you put it in the fridge. Yeah. And then you're playing with the dog and he starts barking and looking over your shoulder and you realize, oh, I left the burner on. So it's melting the plastic. He can smell it. And he's like, dude, what did you do? What's going on over there? Yeah. I don't, you know, that's just an example. That's just an anecdote that didn't happen 4 days
ago.
Your dog
is useful. Mine doesn't. What kind of dog is it?
We don't know. We haven't done the DNA test. We think he's a mixture of like a little bit of terrier, a little bit of cattle dog, a little bit of pointer. We call him, he's our everything bagel. I don't know. He's just
everything
bagel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's asleep at my feet here. We thought he was pretty smart. He's a terrier until I saw him walk into a plate glass window the other day. So we're not so sure how smart Sid is. But I have to say, since the lockdown, the kids have started bonding with him a lot more. And I noticed them just going to kind of hang out and sort of talk to him a little bit, just because, you know, somebody else that's not going to judge you. Until he decided to eat a mouse in front of my daughter. Well, he didn't eat it. He won't eat them, but he found and caught and killed a mouse.
Yeah.
Which was living under my skate ramp. And my daughter has only just forgiven him about 3 days later.
Yeah.
But up until that, he was a fantastic companion that was, you know, giving them something else to talk to and kind of vent on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we had Ragamuffin, who I had found on the side of the highway when he was a puppy, who was like truly a wild dog, like looked like a pariah dog, which is just what dogs start to look like when they go back to many generations of dogs crossbreeding, you know, like the breeds that we think of going back together is just like a 45 to 50 pound reddish dog. And he, on multiple occasions where me and my wife had, like, you know, early in our relationships, like, had adult time and had like a candle lit or something and passed out, and then we left the candle burning forever in like a closed room, and all of a sudden the room is like filling with smoke, and he like jumps on the bed and is like, hey dummy, what are you doing? It's not safe in here anymore. Like this happened multiple times where he would do things like that where he's like, you're doing it wrong, you're stupid, you need someone here to put you back in check. But he was like also escaping from apartments and things like that because he was that smart. And smart dogs are great until they do something smart that you don't want them to do.
Smart dog. That's, oh yeah. I think the idea, like everything, the biggest pro that I have seen so far is basically what you're talking about, which is the dog teaching me things about myself and helping me grow faster and in ways that I didn't realize. And I think I've talked about them before, like confronting like anxiety, confronting your like your instinct to nurture and develop someone or something else, like in realizing and like, I guess, claiming that responsibility and like actively choosing it, as well as forcing the structure that has made me like, I don't know, grow up faster than I recognized. There are just a lot of things where it's like, the most simple that everybody talks about is like, you gotta get up and walk the dog. Like, mm-hmm. You gotta do that. And so you are not gonna have sleeping days anymore. Like, you're gonna hopefully like tag team with your partner and be like, okay, you take them this time. Spoiler alert, you end up doing it together every time. And so yeah. Like that sort of thing has forced a change that I welcome. I don't know that I was like aware of it when it was going to happen. And I think it was amplified by the fact that he's a puppy, or he is and was a puppy when we got him. And so you have to do everything for them.
Yeah. It's imposing structure for someone other than yourself. Right.
Yes.
Like, I think, you know, you don't have kids yet, potentially. I don't know what your children plan is or isn't, but the idea of like, you guys were able to, as two like fully self-sufficient adults, you know, be able to focus on yourself and spend time together. But like, you didn't have that imposition of someone who can't do all of the things by themselves, given the context that, you know, if Rufio was in the wild, he would probably be able to survive, but he's living in an apartment in Brooklyn. And so, you know, all of a sudden you have structure and responsibility, which is inevitably like, you know, it has its pros and cons, certainly, but I think it does sort of take you outside of yourself a little bit. I mean, there are a lot of therapists and psychologists who talk about, you know, the drive towards narcissism, not in sort of a, like, malignant type of way of like truly having a disorder, a narcissistic disorder, but like a hyper focus on yourself can be a cause of anxiety and depression, of like you're sort of trapped inside your own feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And the ability just to extract yourself out of that because you care about an animal can do a lot.
I think that thing of having to get outside is really important. You know, because in many ways the dog walks you too. So, you know, sometimes if I come back from work, I get off a long train taking me out of London out to the countryside, and my wife will say, why don't you go and take Sid for a walk? She doesn't mean that. Sid's probably already been for a walk. He's fine. She's like, you need to get out and you need to go and walk in the forest or go by the river or something.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you know, it makes, certainly for me, one of the benefits is Sid makes me a bit more connected with my environment, with things around me. Because I like to watch the way he interacts with nature, normally squirrels. but, you know, that kind of being forced to get over yourself and get out and, you know, just decompress. The benefits of being in nature are fairly well documented, like the physiological benefits. So I reckon the dog walking is one of the key benefits for me.
Yeah. So pros, they're awesome. Let's do it. The cons. What are the things that people should know that maybe aren't as intuitive that are challenges of raising a dog?
They die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the number one.
Yeah.
That is the number one.
Gus just passed away. He was 16 and he developed mesothelioma, which is rare in humans, but extremely rare in dogs. Like, he had been in an asbestos mine or something like that. And through, like, in the perfect fashion of what he was like a golden retriever, cocker spaniel mix type of dog, looked like Falcor. he was just jolly, like, all the way to the end. He was, like, getting his lungs drained, like, every 2 weeks at the end. And as soon as he got drained, he was just, like, back into, like, extreme jolly mode, and then at the end it was just like, all right, it's time. And it was interesting even just seeing the difference between having to put Ragamuffin to sleep and having to put Gus to sleep, where it was so tumultuous with Ragamuffin. He had like so much anxiety and you know, he was just, I think, abused by the sort of world when he was a puppy and all of that, and that it was much more traumatic. But with Gus, it was like, it was time. It just felt like much more natural and less of an event than when Ragamuffin died. But yeah, it's a hard experience to go through.
I mean, it's like, I think right after we got Rufio, I think that was the thing that I'm a worrier in general, and that was the thing that I started to worry about probably the most. And I realized after a while, like, this is what life is. This is what it is. This is like a representative of every contact and every communication that you have with anybody in the world. It's like you invest something, you get something back, but nothing is forever in that way. And yeah. In all of the groups that I joined, there are a couple subreddits that I joined about dog training and puppy training and all of that. And mixed into all of the advice, people will always put up RIP posts where they're like talking about putting their dogs to sleep and losing their pets. And every single comment says, yeah, no, nothing could have prepared you for it. It is a sad club that a lot of us are a part of. And it's unlike anything, any other type of loss. And if you haven't owned a dog, you just can't get it. You won't be able to be prepared for it. You'll get through it. You will work through it. But it is a unique type of hurt, a unique type of grief, because it's a unique type of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
Yeah, I'd say the structure too is like the flip side. Like, dogs aren't, you know, we haven't structured society to allow dogs to be in all of the spaces. Certainly the number of spaces where we'll tolerate dogs now has increased, but there are places that dogs probably just shouldn't be. And maybe I'm like dogs shouldn't be on a plane. Like, you know, I listen to Bill Simmons' podcast a lot, and he rants on dogs being on planes because it's sort of, you know, people are saying it's a service dog, and it's like that dog can't even sit. You know, like, it's mm-hmm. definitely not a service dog. But, you know, that sort of grounding of like, I need to get home to walk the dog, or I can't go to this thing because of X, Y, and Z, or you have to sort of then create support to be able to do those things that you want to do with someone else caring for the dog. Like, that is, you know, like, there are like mental gymnastics that you go through sometimes to be able to make sure that that dog is doing its thing and you're able to do whatever it is you need to do, even if it's not necessarily like a fun thing, like work trips, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sort of present dynamics that then need to be contended with.
Yeah. I'm constantly petitioning my wife for a second dog, but she won't allow it. Because Sid's a nice size and he's really friendly and people quite like him, and he's easy to farm off on somebody for a couple of days or for a weekend or something. It's no problem. But I've been asking for like a bear sized German Shepherd type, you know, big hairy beast, because I think it'd be brilliant having one small one and one massive one, knowing full well the small one will be in charge.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, yeah, just because you love your dog doesn't mean to say everybody else is going to love your dog. So, you know, make
this
sure
is
you.
So true.
Yeah, you need to consider what size, what kind of breed you get, because other people are going to have to look after it for you too. It's a bit like children, really.
Yeah.
Some people don't love your children that much, but you know.
And you're like, how is that possible? I love it so much.
Exactly.
And they're like, she has no hair. Why does she have no hair?
Or they have.
It'll come.
Or in the dog's case, they have way too much and they shed to the point of, you know, complete disaster zone all over the house. Yeah.
Yo, so minor con, the shedding is real, and it takes a while to figure out what their shedding schedule is. Like,
does Rufio, they have a schedule? Has he got a diary?
Well, I mean,
8 p.m. shed a hair.
If anyone would keep a diary of their dog shedding, it's me. But no, like, there's like, you know, puppy coat to adult coat. That's like a big moment usually. But then there are some breeds as well that are seasonal shedders. There are some that just shed all year round. Some that are both. And especially if you're adopting, you don't necessarily know when he's coming into your house. And so like, Rufio didn't shed that much at all for like 10 months. And in the last month, it's just like, poof, there's just hair everywhere. We are vacuuming two times a day, and it's still everywhere. There's like no stopping it.
Diablo was the same. He had an undercoat and an overcoat. And in the spring and fall, the undercoat would shed. Mm. And there would just be like rolling tumbleweeds through the house. And we're like, we just vacuumed. Like, where is it? And you'd like pet him and it would just be this ball would come off because the undercoat was coming. And he's with my parents now, like I said, and they're like, in the fall, they were like, what the hell is happening right now? Yes. And then they called me the other day and they're like, it's happening again. They're like, why is it happening again? And I'm like, oh, sorry. Like, yeah, that's just gonna, you're gonna have to live with that. Thank you. Love you. Mean it.
It's the same with some humans.
Yeah.
They also shed their teeth, which was a really weird one for us. When
yes.
when Sid was a puppy, our daughter, Joni, who is now 8, was sat there and she was chewing something. And it was at the time where she wasn't 8, she was like a little thing crawling around. And when she would just put anything in her mouth, it was like, oh, what have you found now? Is it a pebble? And she spat out one of Sid's canine teeth.
Fun.
It was the most fun. Horrific thing I've ever seen in my yeah. life. I think both my wife and I retched.
Yeah.
They do shed their teeth when they're puppies as well, which is quite weird.
Yeah.
And like that, the whole, I think I'm just going to call it a con, is like the puppy years.
Yeah.
Like, that's hard, man. Like, I don't know. And Jess and Joey have like lived through it with me, because I would come into the podcast in the morning and be like, guys, I don't know what to do. I'm kind of freaking out right now. I'm like, it's gotten better.
And then he got a dog.
Exactly. Yeah. Well played. Well played. But yeah, like, there's them losing their teeth. There is all of the vaccines that your vet like freaks you out that they may or may not need or have. There's like all the behavioral things that you're trying to figure out. There's all of the information that's out there that is hard, like that's impossible to like decide on, like with like what it is that you're gonna agree to and not agree to, and what's gonna work for your dog and what's not. And like that, I think as a strategist, that was overwhelming to me, because the reality of like, there is no way that you're gonna get the certainty in anything that you truly need in the time that you would like to have it. So you just have to make decisions and respond to what happens. Like, and that is it. That's kind of like how you navigate it. You cannot unlock this one. You cannot solve this one at once and then do it, you know?
Yeah. That brings us to Jess's wrap up pet daycare.
Dogs can be really awesome. Not only are they cute, but they also can be good for our lives. They can bond with our kids. They can hang out with us.
Poop wherever they want.
Being really annoying, but also they are a tremendous responsibility, and they have, kind of like people, a bunch of things that are also weird about having them as roommates, and you're going to have to deal with that and accept that you are forcing them to be in your home. So there are some things you just got to do. Yeah. So adopt responsibly.
And commit to it. That's the only thing that I want to put a button on, is like, if you're going to do it right now, do it. But commit, like, imagine 20 years. Like, think oldest dog that you can possibly think of. Think of where you're going to be in 20 years, where your life might go in 20 years, and commit to having this companion for that long.
Yeah, dog is for life, not just for lockdown.
100%.
Yeah.
Wow. Yes! That's it, yes! Matt. That's honestly like Matt's wrap-up corner inside of Jess's wrap-up corner.
Yo, we need to pull Matt into the corner more often. That was elegant.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in Mackerel Sky Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
We'd like to thank, as always, executive producer and cloud counter Jess Vander, as well as our special guest, Matt Millington, for all of his brilliant English Woodside food genius.
Amen to that. We'd also like to thank sound engineer and, you know what? We're going to call him a ramp herder. You know, the type of food, you know? Alex Contel.
We would like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for our beautiful cover art and for living in the 20008 zip code.
That's anonymous.
Yes.
A zip code.
So you actually have no idea.
Yeah.
We'd also like to thank, you know what, our crew, our dog pound production folk, that kind of works, of Les Jacobs, Tony Vong, and Sarah Gilbert. Thank you, friends.
And as always, thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
for the special thanks, real quick, I just want to say thank you to the memes that have been going around about your roommate as the guy down the bar, of just saying the guy at the other end of the bar is doing blank, and then yes, people saying what their dogs are doing. Like, the guy at the end of the bar is sniffing his butt and just laid down in the corner. Like, things like that. Like,
it's very good.
It's the content we all need.
Amen. Thank you, memes. I'd like to thank Little Debbie. Now, she might be little, but her legacy, writ large. That's what I got to say about that.
Do you think now that you're older that she's now Big Deborah?
All right, Jess, you got me. That was real good. I, you know, God willing, yes.
And what would that snack look like, really? What would a Big Deborah snack be?
And I don't know. I really do believe that, like, there's an Ina Garten touch of, like, class, you know, substance and finesse. Yeah,
that's right.
Like, it's just that, like, the cake itself is just more refined. Like, that's Big Deborah.
Yeah.
Like, Big Deborah, right. Like, you know, she put a bow on it. Done. Boom.
She invites her friends over for a picnic party.
Exactly.
You know?
She's a
gregarious host.
She is, and she doesn't just bake for others. She's baking for herself. Like,
that's
it's not about that. It's like, you know what? What do I want today?
That's right.
That's, yeah, a princess cake. That's what I need. The princess cake, I think, is the...
Is that the one where you put the Barbie in the middle and then it's a giant dome? And then it just looks like a skirt of your doll?
Yes, you are accurate. That is it. That is
I'd like to thank Parm Rinds. And I think you also, Aaron, would probably like to thank Parm Rinds.
I do. I actually made a dairy-free Alfredo sauce the other day, and it totally didn't need a Parm rind in it. Obviously, it was not dairy-free.
No,
it was lactose-free.
It wanted one, probably.
It wanted one. So, like, I threw that in there, and it just made it all the more sumptuous. If you want the recipe, just shoot us an email at criticalnonsense@sylvainlabs.com. But yeah, Parm rinds, 100%. Hundo.
Also, Hundo. Can we thank the Mayans for coming up with smart farming techniques and why we haven't learned from them? It's hard to say.
Yeah, no, well, we got some reasons, but we'll hold off on
got
all that.
Got some reasons. Also, small robots. I could thank my tiny robots.
Tiny robots. And you know what? I want to also, because of course, I'm going to do this on every episode. I want to thank Lego for inspiring the next generation of thinkers to become the engineers who are going to create the next wave of tiny robots. So, like, good on you, Lego.
Honestly, what a genius company. They really figured it out. I'd also like to thank Dog.
Yeah. Yep. No, that one's pretty self-sufficient. I'd like to thank Dog Birthday Biscuits, which we have for when Rufio turns 1 year old, which is in 2 weeks. And like the packaging, the cookies themselves, like I want to eat them. They look like iced animal crackers, and ironically, they're iced crackers for animals. So I don't know what to do with that. I don't think they're human grade. It's a bad idea, but
Have you tried eating Rufio's food?
Not yet. I have really thought about it. You know, it's there. It just doesn't, you know, doesn't smell great.
Yeah, you're like, no, I don't want to taste that. I'll keep my snacks to myself.
And like, maybe that's why I need to have all my Little Debbie snacks around, because I could break down, guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's got caloric density. If we got to that place, there's 30 pounds of a solution that could be gone through. So yeah, we'll see.
That's good. Also, I think I'd like to, as our, maybe my final thanks at least, I like to thank both organizations that are doing everything they can to support those who, in this time of hopefully wasting less, are still unable to get food. Organizations like Feeding America, at least in the States, are doing amazing work. And in terms of dogs, I'm certain that there are plenty of other organizations that are doing their best effort both to get dogs in homes now and also hopefully keep them there. I wonder, we'll do our best to add some notes to the show notes if you're interested in finding out more information of what you can do.
Absolutely. Best Friend Society, Animal Haven, Brooklyn Badass Rescue. These organizations truly are doing awesome things right now. And you guys are awesome, especially Brooklyn Badass. Thank you for giving us Rufio. That was awesome.
Oh, what a good name.
Indeed. Thank you.
Well, I guess that's it. Thanks for joining.
Yeah. Enjoy your snack. Until next time. Snacky, snacky. Bye.
Bye.
It's so good. They did a Twinkie. They did a whole bunch of them. And I think they did, I either looked up the zebra cake afterward or they did the zebra cake. And so this is on the docket for this weekend, even though I literally have 3 boxes coming, I think next week. It's real bad, guys. It's real bad.